Okay, so what we're doing this, we're going to finish up two short things from last week. But what we're really doing this week is we're going to take a look at some personalities, some people who are in the Mishnah, in the Gemara. Some of the names are well known, some will be less well known, I'm assuming, to people. But even if the names are well known, we don't always know the backstories. We want to get some of the stories of some of the more intriguing, I mean, everybody's interesting, but some of the really intriguing personalities that we have in the Gemara. That's what we're going to do this week. Next week, we're going to look at some women, which is very, not next week, in 2 weeks, pretty uncommon in the Gemara. So when we have stories about women, it's really something wonderful. And that's what we'll do for our last class. But today we're going to look at some off the beaten track personalities. And I just chose a rather well beaten track for the picture. Okay, this is just a picture of part of the Roman road. In the Shvela, not so far from Jerusalem, between the road that goes from Jerusalem through Beitar and out to the coast. Near Moshav Mata, we can see it's a very nicely constructed Roman road with these steps going down to make it easier to go on a steep downhill. Nothing to do with what we're talking about today, but a nice picture nonetheless. Okay, so let's go back. I put the sources in the chat. I'm going to put them in one more time if anyone didn't see them yet. And everybody, please mute yourselves. Thank you. Okay, so from last time, we had one subject that we didn't get to. We were talking about others, and this is also connected to 2 times ago. We talked about death, and that's the gladiators. Okay, gladiators, we hear about them in the Gemara in a few different contexts. Okay, they are generally called the ludim. Ludim is like a lot of Latin words in the Gemara, kind of a little bit of a mess in pronunciation, but it comes from the word luda, which means games in Latin, and the ludus was a training school for gladiators, okay, where you could actually go and study to be a gladiator. Why on earth would anyone do this? Because in ancient times, certainly in the Roman Empire, but in pretty much most societies, there's very little upward mobility. And unless you are born into a class that is going to be good for you, i.e., you are male and you have property, there's really very little ways to go up in the world. A gladiator, while definitely a very high-risk job, also, if you're good at it, could be a way to change your social status. You could make a nice amount of money. You might be able to even eventually run one of these schools. So there was this possibility. If you didn't think in those directions, but you just thought, okay, I can't make a living. I can't feed my family. I can't feed myself. The schools take you in. They feed you, right? As they train you, you get, and if that seems like a small thing, it's really not a small thing. So our sources talk about Jews who A, became gladiators, and B, went to gladiator shows. So let's just take a look at some of the sources that we have here. The picture on the top, by the way, is from fresco from Pompeii. I didn't write down where it was from, but it's a great depiction of a gladiator fight. And we know the gladiators sometimes were person-on-person, trained gladiator fighting a trained gladiator. Sometimes it was trained gladiators fighting animals. Sometimes they were just nabal, prisoners of war, Jews, Christians before the Roman Empire became Christian, who are just fodder, either for the animals or for the trained gladiators. So you really had all different kinds of battles. Gemara Yerushalmi, we hear about this in Gittin, in the Yerushalmi and in the Bavli. What happens? We have a mitzvah of pidyon shvuyim, of redeeming captives. But what if somebody voluntarily puts himself into captivity, sells himself to the Gentiles? The Gemara, the Yerushalmi, Gittin, if somebody sells himself and his children to the Gentiles, you don't have to redeem him if he sold himself repeatedly. If he sold himself once, one buys him back. But if he sold himself to the Ludim, one does not buy him back. Meaning, we understand that you did this out of desperation, but we also understand that you did it consciously. You understood the risks that you were taking, and we are, the Jewish community is not responsible to buy him back. Okay, but the Gemara goes on. There was a case of one who sold himself to the Ludin. The case became before Rabbi Abahu, right? Rabbi Abahu Rob of Caesarea, certainly knew a thing or two about gladiators and amphitheaters, who said, "What can we do?" He did it for his livelihood, meaning we have to redeem him. He was in dire straits. He didn't have a lot of choices, and the community is responsible for him. Hey, the most famous gladiator or reformed gladiator is Rish Lakish. Hey, not everybody agrees that when it says Rish Lakish, it says very clearly Rish Lakish sold himself to the Ludim. We have a very well-known story where after he does tshuva and he becomes the chavruta, the study partner of Rabbi Yochanan, at some point Rabbi Yochanan slips and says, "Oh, well, you should know about daggers. You used to be, a fighter," and then this is a terrible breach in their relationship. Not everybody agrees that Ludim means gladiator. Some people think he was a bandit. He was a thief. We have other stories that seem to back up that theory. But here it seems to be we're talking about gladiators. So we have none other than such a famous personality as Reish Lakish, who eventually decides this is not the world for him, and he joins the world of Torah. Now, that's the fighters. What about the audience, right? Are you as a Jew allowed to go to gladiator shows? Our instinctive response would be, "Of course not, right? This is a disgusting thing. How could you go and watch as human life is, used for sport?" And add to that the fact that there often was idol worship at gladiator games. There were sacrifices, there were prayers to the gods, right? It seems very inappropriate, right? But the Tosefta in Avodah Zarah says there are two reasons why you're allowed to go to gladiator games. That's our source over here. If one goes to the Gentiles' theater for government purposes, it is permitted. For enjoyment, it is forbidden. What does that mean, government purposes? If you are a person who has to have dealings with Roman officials, right? There's a VIP box, and anyone from the Roman governor to the Caesar might go to a gladiator game. If you need to schmooze, network, talk to these people, that's a reason why you would be allowed. Okay. What if you're just a regular guy? If one sits in the theater, it is as if he shed blood, right? We understand if there's no audience for these things, no spectators, they're not going to have them. Rabbi Natan allows it for two purposes, because he can shout and save lives, and he can testify that a woman can remarry. So let's understand these two things. This painting on the bottom, this is a 19th century, like, very fanciful depiction of what a gladiator game was, but it's useful for our purposes because if you look at the people in the stands, okay, they are gesturing with their hands and they are gesturing thumbs up or thumbs down, right? The way the fight would go is that the victor would stand over the person who was defeated, look around at the crowd, and the crowd would vote, right? This really was a blood sport. The crowd would vote, should you spare his life or should you kill him? Rabbi Natan says, if you can go as a block, you Jews can go, a large group, and you can raise your voices and your thumbs and save his life, that's allowed. Because you're literally saving someone's life. The other reason you can go is, let's say you have Jewish gladiator and you have a Jew who has been killed in the Colosseum, in the amphitheater. Somebody has to testify, a Jew has to testify that they saw him being killed in order that his wife is not an aguna. Okay? If you have no Jews in the amphitheater, then there's no testimony and she can't remarry, right? She remains an aguna. So two fascinating reasons that really give us a sense of how bloodthirsty this sport is. And while Rabbi Natan might say you're allowed to go, the Chachamim definitely did not encourage people to go. And one of the very famous prayers that we have, right, and we say part of this every time we do the Hadron, every time we finish a Masechet, is we contrast those who sit in the Beit Midrash and those who sit in the theaters, right? And here's one version of it, the Yerushalmi and Brachot. Rabbi Nechunya ben Hakaneh would pray a short prayer when he entered and when he exited the study hall. This is exited, not existed, sorry. Right? I didn't give you the when he entered. It's also beautiful, but for our purposes, when I exit, I give thanks for my lot. What did he say? I thank you, my God and God of my fathers, that you have put me among those who sit in the study halls and the synagogues, and you do not put me among those who sit in the theaters and the circuses. Shesamta chalkenu ben yoshvei Beit Midrash, velo samta chalkenu ben yoshvei teatraot v'kirkasot. Right? And then he says, we both are busy. I work and they work. I am diligent and they are diligent. He's not dismissing their efforts and the fact that they work hard, but I work to inherit paradise and they work towards the grave. Understand what is worthwhile in life. Being a gladiator is not going to bring you to Olam Haba. Alongside gladiators, where do the gladiators perform? They perform in an amphitheater. Okay. If you live in Israel, you are confused because in Israel, we call the half circle where you go and you see performances and you see, Yom HaTzmaut celebrations. We call that an amphi, but it's not. It's a theater. Okay. A half circle is a theater. A full circle is an amphitheater. And that's where the gladiator games were held. This is in the one on the right here is in Caesarea. It starts out as a hippodrome, a place for horse racing. It's not a full circle because the sea has washed away the western side of it, but it started out as a full circle. First it was a hippodrome, then it was an amphitheater. The one on the left is actually perfectly preserved completely. This is an amphitheater that was discovered about 25 years ago, in Beit Guvrin. And it's in pretty much perfect condition. And you can see where the seats were, and you can see where the prisoners were brought through the hallways. And you can even see in the middle, this is a modern covering, but you can see underneath where the animals were brought up from their cages. Relative to the size of the land of Israel, we have a lot of amphitheaters. And we have in Caesarea, we have in Beit She'an, we have in Beit Guvrin. Seems a little bit strange. Why do we have so many? The reason we have so many is that we are on the frontier, and the Romans sent many, many soldiers here. The Jews are troublesome. We have the Great Revolt. We have the Bar Kokhba Revolt. So the soldiers are here, but we're also here because there could be trouble on the border, on the border with the Parthian Empire. There are many soldiers who are stationed in the land of Israel, and soldiers, very nice when you have jobs for them, when they need to go out and conquer or build roads, or, but when they have nothing to do, they are a danger to the populace. You do not want these young men with lots of testosterone just running around and doing whatever they want. You got to keep them busy. You got to keep them happy so they don't rebel, so they don't pillage. So there are games, right? What's the Roman credo? Bread and circuses. You have to feed them and you have to give them entertainment. So that's why we have so many amphitheaters in the land of Israel. With that said, our amphitheaters are very small time country, small town theater. You go, I went for the first time a couple of years ago to Rome. I saw the Colosseum and you're like, oh, okay. That's a real amphitheater, right? Ours are much, much smaller, but they serve purposes that we needed. Okay. A couple of other things that I wanted to finish up from last time. One is something called nidui. The rabbis had all kinds of tools at their disposal, okay, when the second temple is standing, and unclear for how long this is true, but they have all kinds of punishments, right? Anyone who's learning Daf Yomi, Sanhedrin knows the many, many punishments that perhaps the rabbis had at their disposal, unclear for how long, but they had once, even when they were able to do physical punishments, they had other tools to encourage, let's say, people who didn't listen to them to follow them. And these are various forms of excommunication. Nidui, and then the more extreme form, cherem, right? Where the rabbis say, we don't like the way you're behaving. And so you have to cut off your social contact, right? You have to look different. You're not allowed to shave or cut your hair. You need to, other people need to stay away from you. Okay? The punishments can become even more severe. It can go all the way up to physical punishment. Why does a person get put into nidui? Usually it's a case of disobeying the rabbis. Okay? Not in the sense of like, I didn't keep Shabbat, right? For that's an actual punishment that you get in the Beit Din, but I didn't treat the rabbis with respect. I disobeyed the rabbis. Probably the most famous case of putting somebody into cherem is Rabbi Eliezer HaGadol, Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, one of the greatest of the Tanaim, who did not bow to majority rule, and so the rabbis distance themselves from him. Professor Ze'ev Safrai, who wrote the Mishnah to Eretz Yisrael, says that we mostly hear about cases of nidui in the time period of the Yavne generation, right? That first generation after the Beit HaMikdash is destroyed, where Rabban Gamliel and Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai have to work very hard to create unity among a society that had so many sects. And so they use this tool to discourage people from striking out on their own. We're allowed to have machloket, we're allowed to have disagreements, but we have to all stay within certain red lines. So we hear about Nidui with Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus. We hear about the threat of it with Rabbi Yoshua and with Rabban Gamliel from that generation. The Mishnah in Midot talks about practically what would happen if you were put into Nidui in the time of the Beit HaMikdash. Okay? We hear about a method of crowd control, right? This is a drawing of what the southern wall surrounding the Temple Mount look like, right? If anybody's been to the southern excavations in Yerushalayim, and you have what are called Sha'arei Chulda, the Chulda gates, and you have a set of two gates on the west, right? And you have three gates on the east. Today we have these three gates are closed up, but we have who just erased my picture. Okay. But we have remnants of them, and the two, we have very, very little that's left. But the Mishnah talks about these gates, right? And it says, all who entered the Temple Mount entered by the right, we're talking about if you're facing the wall, so the right is the east here, and went out by the left. We don't want everybody going in wherever they want because that could lead to chaos and God forbid people could get trampled. We're talking about thousands of people on a holiday. So everyone who came in would come in on this side, do what they have to do, and exit over here. Okay? Save for one to whom something had happened, who entered and went round to the left. They would go the opposite way. And obviously, if everybody, hundreds of people are going one way and you are the one outlier going the other way, people are going to say to you, hey, didn't you see the signs? Why are you going the wrong way? Why do you go around to the left? So there are two possible answers. Because I am a mourner, right? I am an avel, then you have the opportunity that people have the opportunity to comfort him. May he who dwells in this house comfort you. That one we understand. Right, we understand the concept of comforting the mourner. The other answer is different, is strange, because I am excommunicated. I am in nidui. Why do I need to tell people that? Well, maybe so they'll stay away from me, but also so they will encourage me to do tshuva. You have two interesting answers here. Rabbi Meir says, may he who dwells in this house inspire them to draw you near again. Rabbi Meir says, I hope that the Chachamim forgive you. Rabbi Yossi said, you make it seem as if they treated him unjustly. Rather, they should say, may he who dwells in this house inspire you to listen to the words of your colleagues so that they may draw you near again. We hope that you do tshuva. Right? And this is a very interesting thing. It's really an example of Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh LaZeh. Everybody's responsible for each other. Today we'd say, well, what is it your business if somebody else sinned? No, that's not the Jewish approach. The Jewish approach is you did something wrong. We have to give you tochacha. We have to tell you. We have to encourage you to come back to repent. And this is a very, very public way to do that. Okay, one last thing before we get to our personalities, and it's kind of a lead into our personalities, and that is names. What were popular names in the time of the Mishnah and the Gemara? And it's actually a very interesting thing. Okay, so we have essentially four categories of names, right? And this is what I wrote you here. We have names that are from Tanakh, okay? Not all the names of Tanakh, as we'll see, but names that are from Tanakh that are very popular, right? Reuven, Shimon, Levi, right? The sons of Yaakov. We have Yoshua. We have Yitzchak. Fascinating. We have names that are today, we'd say, are the classic names, right? Go to any Haredi neighborhood and call out Moshe, Avram, David, Shlomo, Yisrael. 20 kids are going to come running. In the time of the Mishnah and the Gemara, These are not names that are used. We rarely, I think there's one Rabbi Avraham. We don't hear about a David. It's strange because these are important figures. They're not popular names. In fact, we have the very famous statement, right, about Maimonides, Moses Maimonides, Mi Moshe ad Moshe lo kam ki Moshe, right? From Moshe to Moshe, we don't have anyone like Moshe. Obviously, it's meant to be praise of Maimonides, but it's also very, literal. There are not other Moshes. We don't hear about a Rabbi Moshe who is a Tana or an Amora. It's just very uncommon. Then we have other names that are Hebrew, but they are not Tanakh names, right? Like Gamliel, Meir, light, right? Yohanan, Akiva, which is like, Akev, Yaakov. They're Hebrew names, but they're not Tanakh names, right? Then we have names that are Aramaicized Hebrew, right? Instead of saying Yosef, we say Yossi. Instead of saying Tuvia, we say Tabai. So this makes a lot of sense. Certainly the Jews of Eretz Yisrael and also in Babel, they speak a lot of Aramaic. They're taking names and they're turning them into Aramaic. In fact, right, anyone who's been learning the daf, we just had a daf about cursing God, blessing God, right? And we don't want to say Hashem's name in the testimony. What do you say? Yakeh Yossi et Yossi, right? It's such a popular name that we use it as a stand-in for God's name. Okay, all of these are Hebrew derivations of Hebrew, but then we have these interesting outliers. We have quite a lot of names that are Greek or Latin derived. Okay, Antigonus, Lulianus, Dosa, Papos, Sumacus, or Sumchus, Tarphon, right? Just like today, we've got Paul, we've got Mark, we've got all those kinds of names. Okay? Jews chose those names as well. We also have a phenomenon that we don't have in Tanakh, but we definitely still have today, of parents naming children for the earlier generation, right? Look at the dynasty of Rabban Gamliel. It's very confusing because everybody is Gamliel who has a son Shimon, who has a son Gamliel, who has a son Shimon, right? Everybody's one following the other, following the other, following the other. We have Yossi ben Chalafta, who has a son named Chalafta. We have Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, who has a son named Hyrcanus. So it's something that's very normal to us, but I almost never, perhaps never, see it in Tanakh. We also have names that people would not use today, like Yishmael. Okay, Rabbi Yishmael, one of the most important of the Tanaim. We don't use that name anymore, but it was not considered a name that there was anything pejorative about it. We'll see there are names that are pejorative. Okay, so what's on the list of top 10 baby names in the time of the Tanaim? Shimon sweeps everybody, right? There's more Shimons than anybody else. We're going to see today. We're going to see Shimon ben Azai, Shimon bar Yochai, Shimon ben Zoma. There are lots and lots and lots of Shimons. There are lots of Yehudas, Elazar, Eliezer. By the way, this is why it's often very confusing, right? You're learning a Mishnah, you're learning Gemara, and you have a Rabbi Shimon or Rabbi Yehuda. Which one is it? Is it the Tana? Is it the Amora? Which one, right? Very confusing. Okay. We have a lot of interesting statements. Not a lot. We have a few interesting statements about names. Probably the most famous one. Is there a couple of variations of this? I brought you the one from Shir HaShirim Rabbah. Why was Israel redeemed from Egypt, right? Four matters. They did not change their name. They did not change their language. They did not speak slander. And they weren't steeped in licentiousness. Okay, we won't go into the other ones. But they did not change their names. Now, here's where we get something very interesting. First of all, they did change their names. Moshe is an Egyptian name. It's probably the classic Egyptian name. But we won't go into the time period of Yetziat Mitzrayim. What are Chazal doing? Reuven and Shimon descended to Egypt. Reuben and Shimon ascended. They did not call Reuven Rufus. They did not call Shimon Luliani, Yosef Listus, Binyamin Alexander. Hello, these are not Egyptian names. These are Greek names. These are Roman names. Chazal are talking about their time period. They do not like this idea, but yet it's very clear that people are using those names. Look at the, we'll go back to the middle one in a minute, but look at the last source from the Gemara in Gittin, bills of divorce that come from a country overseas, right, from Medinat Hayam, witnesses are signed upon them. Even though the names of the witnesses are like the names of Gentiles, they are valid because the names of most Jews outside of Eretz Yisrael are like the names of Gentiles. Chazal might not want to admit it, but there are plenty of Jews inside of Eretz Yisrael who also use the names of Gentiles. So Chazal are against this idea, but for sure people did it anyway. However, there was a red line that people didn't cross, and that's this middle source here, right? Nobody names their children after Rishaim. Have you ever heard of someone naming their child Paro, Sisra, Sancheiriv, right? We don't name after
What is
Rishaim.
Yishmael?
Now you will notice what Yishmael is not necessarily a Rasha, right? Yishmael, at least in the Pshat, is not a Rasha. Right? Yishmael is a complicated character. Chazal don't really like him. But first of all, the meaning of his name, Yishmael, it's a beautiful meaning. And I don't know, they got past it. We didn't, we don't today. Names go in and out of fashion. Right? I always say this, you go into any kindergarten in Brooklyn today, you will find Max and Sadie and Sophie, right? They're these names that have come back from the 20s and the 30s. They're now popular today. And this is true for Chazal as well. Now you will notice that we do not have names of women because there are so few women that are mentioned in the Mishnah and the Gemara that we can't do any kind of a study. We just don't know. We don't have enough. We don't have enough from ossuaries. We have some names, but we don't have enough names that we could say these are the most popular names. Well, we'll get to some women, but we definitely don't know enough to say. Okay, so now let's talk a little about different personalities. We're going to go more or
There's no
less
way to explain every
chronological
small.
order, not 100%. Don't hold me to it completely. Okay, people who are not muted, please mute yourself. Okay, so let's start with somebody named Yonatan Ben Uziel. Yonatan Ben Uziel is an interesting character because he is, on the one hand, the way he's written about, he's clearly very holy, very revered. On the other hand, we have very little that is written in his name. Okay, so the classic statement, the classic biographical mention of Yonatan ben Uziel is here in Bava Batra. The sages taught Hillel HaZaken, Hillel the elder, meaning Hillel as in Hillel and Shammai, had 80 students. 30 of them were sufficiently worthy that divine presence should rest upon them. 30 of them were sufficiently worthy that the sun should stand still for them, and 20 were on an intermediate level. The greatest was Yonatan ben Uziel. The least was Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai. Okay, if the least is Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, we're setting the bar pretty high here. Why do we have very, very few statements of Yonatan ben Uziel if he was really such a brilliant and significant figure? So one suggestion is that he is included every time that the Mishnah or the Gemara talks about Beit Hillel, right? The Talmidei Beit Hillel or the teachings of Beit Hillel, he's kind of subsumed under that because he was the best student of Hillel, which I think is a reasonable answer. He's a contemporary of Shammai and of Hillel, right? He's in the first generation of Tanaim. And we have another really fascinating statement at the bottom here. Yonatan ben Uziel, when he sat and was engaged in Torah, a bird that flew over him was immediately incinerated. Right? So this could either be very fanciful. Rashi says when he taught Torah, the Torah was so beautiful that the angels would come and listen. And of course, if angels are there, there's fire there as well. Right? Tosfos says, yeah, when Yonatan ben Uziel taught Torah, it was as if there was Matan Torah again, also fire. Rav Aaron Hyman, who wrote biographies of the Tanaim and the Amoraim, has a more prosaic explanation. He says this is metaphorical. When he taught Torah, he would burn up any opinions that were against him. He would just be so on fire, right? We say that today, with his arguments that nobody could defeat him in any way. Now, we have very interesting two stories that seem to be the same story, but with different protagonists. Gumara and Baba Batra, the third story here, this is talking about whether somebody who can rescind his inheritance from his children because he doesn't like the way they're behaving. Okay? And we have a story here where there was an incident involving a man whose children did not act properly. He arose and wrote a document transferring all his property to Yonatan ben Uzziel, meaning he doesn't want his children to inherit this property. Shammai comes along and Shammai says, you have to keep the property. And Yonatan ben Uzziel says, no, I'm going to give it back to the children. And Yonatan ben Uzziel manages to best Shammai in this story. But we have another story where the characters are the same, but the who does what is inverted. And take a look here. And this one is, I think, the more interesting one and perhaps the correct one. This is from the Yerushalmi. Yonatan ben Uzziel's father vowed not to let him have any enjoyment from his property. And in his will, he gave his part to Shammai. Now, why would Yonatan ben Uzziel's father not want this very holy, very learned son not to have his property? Perhaps because he is a Shammaiite, right? We know Shammai and Hillel. They're two very different schools who argued about many things. If Yonatan ben Uzziel is giving his property to Shammai, clearly he's a disciple of Shammai. Who's Yonatan ben Uzziel? He's the prime student of Hillel. Maybe he doesn't like the path that his son is going on. But in this version, Shammai does the different thing than what he does in Baba Batra. He actually is very generous. What did Shammai do? He sold some of the property. He gave some to the Hekdesh, to the Beit HaMikdash. He gave Yonatan the remainder as a gift. Said he wants to attack this gift. Let him first get back the merchandise from the buyers and the Hekdesh. After that, he can get the remainder back from this. Right? So it's an inversion. In the Baba Batra story, Shammai is trying to follow what the father wants and not give the children the property, and Yonatan ben Uzziel does it. But in Nedarim, Shammai is the one who retrieves this property and gives it to Yonatan ben Uzziel, who's the rightful owner. Right? Very interesting. Now, I said we don't have Torah, very much Torah from Yonatan ben Uzziel. What do we have? We have a Targum, a translation. Okay? Take a look over here in Megillah. The translation of the prophets was composed by Yonatan ben Uzziel based on Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. When he wrote his translation, Eretz Yisrael quaked over an area of 400 parsa by 400 parsa, and a divine voice emerged and said, "Who is this who has revealed my secrets to mankind?" When you write a Targum, right, you're writing in Aramaic, which is the language that most people speak. God is not so happy. How are you making all of my secrets known to everybody? And this was only when he would translate the Nach, the Nevi'im, and the Ketuvim. And of course, he was not able to translate the Torah, which is much holier, because that would have really made the whole world shake. So when you open up a Chumash, you will see inside a Targum Yonatan. Right? Why? There is no Targum Yonatan on Chumash. There's only a Targum Yonatan on Nach. Targum Yonatan on Chumash is not Targum Yonatan. It's called by scholars, they call it pseudo Yonatan, pseudo Jonathan. We don't actually know who wrote it. It's probably around the same time as Yonatan ben Uzziel, but it's not Yonatan ben Uzziel. How did it get attributed to him? Mostly because Targum Yonatan is the same initials as Targum Yerushalmi, which is what this is often called. Okay? And at a certain point, people got mixed up. But Targum Yonatan on the Torah does not exist, only on the Nach. Now, Yonatan ben Uzziel's life story took an interesting twist in the 20th century. Already from the Middle Ages, Jews were making Aliyah LaRegel to a grave in a place called Amuka, okay, in the forest of Birya outside of Tzfat. And this was considered to be the kever of Yonatan ben Uzziel. Fine, there are many, many places that people would go on Aliyah LaRegel. This is not unusual at all. However, some point in the mid-20th century, there's disagreement about it, was it the 50s, was it the 70s, the kever of Yonatan ben Uzziel in Amuka became associated with the place to go to get a shidduch. Okay? Why is this? It's It's a very good question. Some people said, oh, Yonatan Uziel was never married, and therefore this is he's going to pray for you to get a shidduch. Nowhere in the Gemara does it say that Yonatan ben Uziel was never married. It doesn't say he was married, but it also doesn't say he wasn't married. Other people say, well, it's related to the word amukah, which Rashi says go someplace that is amukah mikulam to get a shidduch, and somebody messed this up. In any case, it's developed over the last few decades to the extent that today people come to Israel, they go on a kfarim tour, they have single children, they must go to Amuka to daven for a shidduch. Single people go and leave their sitter by accident on purpose in Amuka with their telephone numbers in it. It's become a thing, right? Where it came from, not so important anymore. Just people are now doing it, and it's taken on an aspect of kind of folk religion. Okay. Let's go to our next personality. This is another very interesting person that we don't have so much Torah from him, but we have a couple of very interesting stories about him. And this is somebody named Choni HaMa'agel. Choni is not a rabbi. He's not called a rabbi. He lives in the time period of the first century before the Common Era. Hey, we know that because in the most famous story about him, where he prays for rain, he is chastised by Shimon ben Shetach, hey, who lives in the first century before the Common Era. He is considered to be somebody who's very close to God, but who makes demands on God, right? So we have this fascinating story in the Mishnah and Ta'anit, and the Gemara adds to it. The Ta'anit, the Masechet Ta'anit, talks about when do you fast, and one of the main reasons you fast is if there's no rain, right? If there's no rain at a certain point in the winter, by a certain point in the winter, there are public fasts. Now, at some point, there was no rain and the fasting wasn't working, and the people came to Choni HaMa'agel, who was known as somebody who was very holy and some sort of a miracle worker. And they said, pray that rain should fall. He said to them, go out and bring in the ovens used to roast the Paschal lamb so that they will not dissolve. Meaning, what time of year is it? It's already springtime. Hey, they're preparing the ovens for the Korban Pesach, and there hasn't been rain. That's very bad. He prayed, and no rain fell at all. What did he do? He drew a circle, and he stood inside it, and he said before God, Master of the universe, your children have turned their faces toward me as I am like a member of your household. Therefore, I take an oath by your great name that I will not move from here until you have mercy upon your children. Okay? Essentially, he says, I'm not leaving this circle, Hashem, until you bring down rain. And then the rain starts to fall. It's too much rain, right? It says that the people say, just as you prayed over rain that it should fall, pray that it should stop. It's too little. It's too much. Choni is giving all these demands to God. And Shimon ben Shetach says, if you weren't Choni, I would put you in nidoi, right? Remember nidoi. You're being very disrespectful, disrespectful to God, disrespectful to the system that the rabbis have set up of these fasts and prayers. You want a shortcut. You want a miracle, right? Zev Safrai says he's one of the Hasidim. These like miracle workers, lahavdil, not so different from what we hear about Jesus in the stories of the Gospels, right? People who are kind of like circumventing the regular forms of prayer, fasting, calling out to Hashem, and he's looking for a shortcut. And the people need it. God listens to him, but Shimon ben Shetach says, this is not the way that we're supposed to be going about things. And we'll get to the other really famous story about him in a minute, but what about his name? Okay, Choni HaMa'agel is usually translated as Choni the Circle Maker. Right? Ma'agal, Igul, right? He's a circle maker. And we know he's a circle maker in his most famous story. He draws a circle, he stands in the middle of the circle. That's one possibility, okay? Meaning he got the name after this story happened. But if we don't want to say that, if we said this was always his name, then we have to think of a different explanation, or maybe more than one explanation. Okay. Another possibility we have in the Sefer Yuchsin, which is from the time of the Gaonim, it says that Choni comes from a town called Maglo, meaning he's Choni Hamagloi, right? It's kind of a distortion of his name, which has two meanings, right? You have another guy named Nachum Ish Gamzo or Ish Gimzu. He comes from a place called Gimzu, but he's also the guy who was always saying Gamzu Latova. It could mean both things. My favorite explanation for Konya Ma'agel is we have a tool that was used probably up until very recently called a Ma'agela. You can see it over here in the top picture over here. This is a tool that has it's a roller, right? It has a handle and then it has a round stone. What do you use it for? When you put plaster over the straw or the wood beams on your ceiling so that it doesn't rain, it doesn't leak in the winter time, you then have to roll and flatten the plaster. And this is what Choni's job was. He was a ma'agel. He worked with the ma'agela. So it could be one, it could be two, it could be all three. There's no reason why none of these things are disagreeing with each other. The other really nice little archaeological part of the story is that when there's too much rain, okay, the people say to him, pray that the rain should stop. He says, go out and see if the claimant stone, in Hebrew it's the Evan HaTo'en, has been washed away. Okay? And we have another source in the Gemara that talks about how if you're in Yerushalayim and you lost something, anyone who lost something, anyone who found something would go to the Evan HaTo'en. Okay. This is the lost and found of Yerushalayim. If you imagine Yerushalayim, Aliyah LaRegel, thousands and thousands of people on the main street, of course, people are going to lose jewelry, money, children. You need a lost and found. Okay. So there was a place where you could go and proclaim what you found or proclaim what you lost. A few years ago, in excavations in Ir David, on the main street that went up from the Shiloh pool towards Har HaBayit, the excavators found this strange platform. Okay. It's a platform that is not an entrance to a store. We have stores. This is not an entrance to a store. It's kind of like a freestanding platform on the street. What was it used for? So there are all kinds of suggestions. Some people say it was like a Hyde Park. It was a place where you would go and you could speak and people would listen to you. Some people said, no, it's built by the Romans, used for crucifixions, right? Everybody can see. Other people said, no, this is the Evan HaTo'en. This is it. This is on the main street. It's a place where you can go up. It's high up, right? You want to go see that the rain hasn't reached up to the top of the Evan HaTo'en. Maybe this is what it is, right? Very nice. No proof. We don't have a sign that says Evan HaTo'en, but certainly could be. Okay. Now, the other famous story about Choni, is that he falls asleep for 70 years. Okay. It's a beautiful and long story. I only brought a little bit of a piece of it. If you want to read the whole story, Tanit 23a, I brought you the beginning of it. One day he was walking along the road when he saw a man planting a carob tree. Choni said to him, this tree, how many years does it take till it will bear fruit? The man said, 70 years. Choni said to him, are you going to live 70 years? He said to him, that man, meaning himself, found a world full of carob trees, just as my ancestors planted for me, I am planting for my descendants. And this is the part of the story that is often quoted by people. It's a beautiful story, right? We always have to think of the future and not only of what's good for us, but the story continues. Choni sat down, he ate, he went to sleep, and he slept for 70 years. Now, the end of the story is really very tragic because he wakes up, he goes to the Beit Midrash, nobody knows who he is. Not only have his children died, he doesn't even have grandchildren anymore. Everybody he's ever learned with has died. He just lives in this world where he knows nothing, he understands nothing, nobody knows who he is. Rabbi Benny Lau suggests that this is kind of like a tikkun. This is fixing. Choni wanted the shortcut. He wants the miracle. He wants the, I'm going to stand in the circle till you bring the rain. And Hashem says, okay, I'll give you the rain, but understand that process is important. Time is important. Things have to take place over a long period of time. There are no shortcuts. One nice little end point. Choni's grave is considered to be in Chatzor HaGlilit up north near Tzfat. And the day that is marked as his yahrzeit site is the 5th day of the month of Iyar, otherwise known as Yom HaTzmaut. Maybe Choni has to learn that the process of redemption like Yom HaTzmaut, took a long time, right? It's a very long, drawn-out process. Okay, another character who's very unusual and interesting, also not called Rabbi, Ben Azai. Okay, we have Ben Azai and Ben Zoma. They usually go together, as you see in this Gemara appearance in Sanhedrin. Okay, we have a whole list in Sanhedrin of people who have different titles. Dorshim lifnei chachamim, danim lifnei chachamim, right? All different kinds of things. So we have, they deliberated before the sages, danim lifnei chachamim. Who are these? This is where we find out Ben Azai's first name, which, as we said, most common first name, right? Shimon ben Azai, Shimon ben Zoma, Hanan the Egyptian, Hananiah ben Chachinai. These guys are students. They have not gotten smicha. Right. And one suggestion why Ben Azai and Ben Zoma don't get smicha is because they die young. But they are important enough that they can ask questions to the Chachamim. They're not rabbis who are included in the Sanhedrin, but they're like one level below. And Ben Azai was considered to be very brilliant, right? Both Abaye and Rava want to compare themselves to Ben Azai in their more brilliant moments, right? Abaye said, "Behold, I am like Ben Azai, who would teach in the markets of Tveria." Right? The picture that I brought you here, because I have no picture of Ben Azai, is the entrance to the ancient city of Tveria. This is the gateways, right? So Ben Azai was somebody who was not a rabbi, but he was known as somebody who was very brilliant. Hey, we have this other compliment. When Ben Azai died, the diligence ceased. We have statements of his in Pirkei Avot. He used to say, "Do not despise any Mayan, do not discriminate against anything, for there is no man that has not his hour, and there is no thing that has not its place," right? Ein lecha adam she'ein lo sha'a, right? Very powerful saying. Now, Ben Azai has two interesting and unusual things about him. First of all, he never marries, right? We said Yonatan Ben Uziel, people say he never married. We have no proof of that. But Ben Azai, we know he doesn't marry. Okay? In a discussion in the Gemara in Yevamot, skip down to here for a second. He's talking about Pru Urvu, and the other rabbis say to him, "Who are you to talk about Pru Urvu? You don't have any children. You never got married. You're not doing Pru Urvu." And he says, "Yes, it's a mitzvah. It's important, but what can I do? Nafshi chashka b'Torah. My soul yearns for Torah. Hey, I can't. I can't. The only thing I want in my life is to study Torah. Is possible for the world to be maintained by others." Now, this is very, very unusual. Chazal do not condone this. They don't like this idea. The Rambam says, okay, if you have no yetzer for arayot, then it's okay. You can sit and learn Torah. How many people are like that? Very few. But the rabbis are not into this idea. Tosfot asks a very interesting question. He says, well, look at the Gemara and Ketubot. Right, take a look here. Discussing Rabbi Akiva and Rachel, then talks about Rabbi Akiva's daughter, right? Just like Rachel supported Rabbi Akiva when he went off to learn Torah and she lived, in poverty, Rabbi Akiva's daughter did the same thing for Ben Azai. This explains the folk saying the you follows the you. The daughter's actions are the same as the mother's, which is actually very nice because a you is a Rachel, right? Rachel, b'ikvot Rachel. Rachel is a lamb, but it's also Rabbi Akiva's wife. Okay, fine. But did Ben Azai marry Rabbi Akiva's daughter? So Tosfot says, no. She was engaged to him, but they didn't end up getting married. Okay, so very interesting. Ben Azai doesn't get married. He's a scholar. He's not given smicha, okay? And he has this very he feels very superior, right? So we have this very strange statement he says in the Gemara in Bechorot. Ben Azai says, "All the sages of Israel appear to me as garlic peel, klipat hashum, except for this bald one." The bald one is Rabbi Akiva. Not exactly a very respectful statement, right? First of all, he's dissing all the other rabbis. And second, he's not exactly being very nice about Rabbi Akiva. What does this statement mean? So I'm going to offer a very strange explanation. You can take it or leave it. Why does he use this comparison of the garlic peel? We know that in Chazal, garlic is considered to be an aphrodisiac. and B, something that encourages fertility, let's put it that way. And we even have that one of the Takanot of Ezra, right? One of the things that Ezra instituted was that people should eat garlic on Friday nights because Friday night is when you're supposed to have relations and you should have garlic, right? The two things go together. Maybe Ben Azai is saying all of the rabbis, they eat their garlic, right? They're married, they're having children, but even me, I don't eat garlic, but I am more knowledge than all of them. I have more Torah than all of them. Maybe, I don't know. Hey, the other thing we know about Ben Azai, the other strange thing, is he is one of the four who are Nichnesula Pardes. Okay, we're going to talk about Acher in a minute. But we have four who enter the orchard. What's entering the orchard? This is Chazal's code for saying studying mysticism, studying things that are not normally meant to be studied, right? We hear the story in Chagiga, which is basically a lot about Maaseh Merkava and all of this mystical literature. We have four who study these things. The only one who emerges whole in every way is Rabbi Akiva. Okay? What happens to Ben Azai? Ben Azai hitzitz v'nifga. He hitzitz v'met, right? He glimpsed and he died. And he's not able to, whatever this means, he's not able to accept or understand this mystical knowledge. Maybe this is partly why he's in the markets of Tveria, right? Why is he in the markets of, that's a strange thing, right? Why is he in the market of Tveria? Why is he outside? He's an outsider. He never gets smicha. He doesn't get married. He wants to study things that other people don't study. His place is on the outside. His brilliance is out in the market, but it's not in the normal social settings of the Beit Midrash, of the Beit Knesset, right? He's an interesting character. Okay, very famous person, we'll look at for a few minutes, is one of the other people who goes into the Pardes. And this is someone who is called by the rabbis Acher, the other. But he has a real name. His real name is Elisha ben Abuya. And he is very much a cautionary tale. He is a cautionary tale because he, according to the Gemara in Chagiga, when he studies this mysticism, that's what makes him become a heretic. But we also have all sorts of other sources, both in Chagiga and Midrash Rut Rabbah and other places, that seem to indicate that his heresy is because of what he sees in the world, not in mysticism, not in the heavens, but in the real world. What does he see in the real world? He sees the power of the Romans, the power as well as the evil of the Romans. He sees Rasha v'Tovlo. Okay? The Roman Empire is clearly evil. We just talked about the gladiators. They do not keep Torah. They are idolaters. They are cruel. They are murderous, and they are super powerful. Okay? What does that mean, right? What does that tell us about Schar Mitzvah, right? And he sees the Jewish people who are clearly following God, and yet are suffering in every way. And we have this Gemara here in Ruth Rabbah. Hey, we have different interpretations of why Elisha goes off the derech, right? One is that he sees a boy who listens to his father, climbs up into a tree, gathers the eggs, sends the mother bird away, right? He does two mitzvot that you're supposed to have long life for, obeying your parents and shiluach hakan. Falls out of the tree and dies. And he says, well, how could this be, right? He's not getting sachar in this world. That's one way, one answer why he leaves Torah. But the other one, which I think makes more sense, some were saying he saw the tongue of Rabbi Yehuda the baker, right? Rabbi Yehuda Nachtom, given to the mouth of the dog, meaning he saw these haruge malchut, he saw these martyrs that the Romans are killing because they study Torah. Elisha said, if the tongue which occupied itself every day in Torah is treated thus, how much more so the tongue of the one who knows nothing and is not occupied in Torah? And he said, if so, there is no reward for the righteous and no resurrection of the dead. Right? He looks around, he says, clearly, the good people are being punished. The bad people are being rewarded. Now, the Medrash obviously cannot leave it at that, right? And says he did not know that it had been interpreted by Rabbi Akiva that you may fare well, tov, in the world that is entirely good and have a long life, ha'arach te'yamim, in the length, the aroch of eternity. Meaning, Schar mitzvah b'hai olma almaleka. You don't get mitzvah for your good deeds in this world. There's another world, and there you're going to get your reward. But Rabbi Akiva and his teachings, right, or Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, or Rabbi Yishmael, all of these people who suffer for their Torah, they are unusual. They are the exception. We hear the stories from them because we learn Mishnah and Gemara. They're the ones who write it. But Acher's response, the Romans are doing bad things, but they are the powerful ones. That's the normal response. Hey, Rabbi Akiva is the outlier. Chazal present Acher as the outlier. And Acher becomes a heretic, goes over to the side of the Romans, and not only is he a traitor to God, he's a traitor to man. Hey, he gives over people to the Romans. He's a moser, and he does all sorts of bad things. And yet, his prime student is Rabbi Meir. Hey, Rabbi Meir follows Elisha ben Abuya. He walks after him on Shabbat when Elisha ben Abuya is riding on his horse. And Elisha ben Abuya says, "Stop walking. You've reached the Tchum Shabbat." He's clearly still a brilliant scholar, and Rabbi Meir wants to learn from him. And the Gemara in Chagiga says, "How is this possible?" All right, Rabbi Bar Shela found Eliyahu. He said to Eliyahu, "What is the Holy One, blessed be He, doing?" Eliyahu said to him, "He is stating halachot transmitted by all of the sages, but he, in the name of Rabbi Meir, he will not speak." He said to him, "Why?" He said, "Because he learned halachot from the mouth of Acher." He said to him, "Why should he be judged unfavorably for that?" Rabbi Meir found a pomegranate, ate its contents, and threw away its peel. He said to him, "Indeed, your defense has been heard from above. Now God is saying, my son Meir says," right? This is a very difficult thing. The rabbis have difficulty with it. Can you learn from somebody whose actions are reprehensible? Rabbi Meir is able to do it. Not everybody's able to do it. Okay? Rabbi Meir also tries to bring Elisha back to do tshuva. After many days, Elisha, the son of Avuya, became sick, and they said to Rabbi Meir, "Elisha, your teacher is sick." He went to greet him and said, "Repent." And Elisha responded, "Who after this they would accept me?" And Rabbi Meir said, "You return man to dust until the crushing of the soul." As soon as he heard this, Elisha ben Avuya wept and died. Rabbi Meir rejoiced and said, "My teacher was taken as he repented." Okay, much more to say about Elisha ben Avuya if you're interested in this story. Beautiful, somewhat fictionalized work by a rabbi named Milton. I'm blanking on his last name. I want to say Milton.
Steinberg.
Thank you. I wanted to say Milton Friedman. That's clearly not who it is. Okay, As a Driven Leaf. Beautiful, beautiful book. And
Milton
yes,
Steinberg.
Milton Steinberg. Thank you very much. I knew somebody would knew that. Okay, we are going to stop here and take a look at comments, and we'll finish up the ones I didn't get to on time. All right, let's see. Israelites kept Jewish names in Egypt. Some names are Jewish, right? But yeah, Midrash is not to be taken literally. I agree with you, Susanna. Moshe is Mos is an Egyptian name. A cousin Hagar, yes, Hagar. You definitely hear people named Hagar, not Ishmael, but Hagar, yes. It looks like a roller paintbrush. Yes, I agree. Okay, anybody else have comments, questions? Usually we have so many comments, so quiet today. What's going on? I will
Shiloh
reiterate that we are not having class next week. Yes, Mel, what can you
HaKain.
tell us?
Shiloh HaKain, not Shiloh HaKan. It's a Kan Sipor. That's smichut. But when you say Shiloh HaKain, HaKan, that's incorrect.
Thank you.
Thank you. Everything was great.
Okay, anybody else?
Well, it's
Okay.
very interesting that they that in the book of Hosea, in the first perek, it's written that God told him to read the name of his daughter to Lo Ruchama.
Hello, Ruchama, but you are Ruchama.
I'm
And we have Ruchamas today. Okay. Thank you, everyone. Have a Shabbat Shalom. We will reconvene in 2 weeks.
Thank you.
Shalom.
Bye, everybody.